Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to Open Source 12 here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Scotty Hertz, full of milk and honey and ready to rock. Or is it Rock'em Sock'em? I don't know.
That's a spoiler for later.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, a little bit of a teaser there.
All right. Open Source is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show. You can find us here every Thursday at 5 p.m. as we talk about the latest news from Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and around the world. And we even sometimes interview local newsmakers and politicians. This week's interview will be with Robert McCabe, who is the founder of Recovery Speaking, a charity that helps people with limited means recover from their trauma. McCabe's group is sponsoring a screening of the documentary Prey this Saturday at the River Run Center, and we will also be joined by telephone with the film's director, Matt Gallagher. That will be at the bottom of the hour. Before that, we are going to talk about the first days of public hearings into the Trump impeachment, where there were new insights, but did they have the desired effect? And then, to start off, we're going to talk about you-know-who, but first, we have a special announcement.
Yes, get your dialing finger ready. 519-837-CFRU, 519-837-2378. We have a pair of tickets to give away for Men of the Deep's Christmas in the Mine. It's on Saturday, November 30th at 7 p.m., the Guelph Infinity Music Series presented by the River Run Center. If you haven't heard of Men of the Deep's, Rita McNeil's backup band, I guess, for the longest time, Working Man. They tour quite regularly. I saw them a few years ago with my father. Excellent show. I didn't see the Christmas show, but it sounds like there's a Christmas theme. 519-837-CFRU, 519-837-2378. Give us a call, and the pair of tickets will be yours to our first caller. Our operator is standing by.
All right. So let's get to Mr. Cherry. As his friends call him. I don't know. But no,
big
on
D, yeah.
A big D.
Big D.
That's an apt one. So on Saturday night, there was the Hockey Night in Canada segment. Don Cherry, considering he's hired to talk about hockey, went off topic and talked about not hockey matters. Talked about those people who don't wear poppies, how they come from somewhere else to enjoy the milk and honey here in Canada. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but I mean, I'm hitting all the
You're
highlights.
Really, really close.
people heard that, and by 48 hours later, actually less than 48 hours later, he was fired. Marks the end of an era. Don Cherry's been with Hockey Night in Canada since, I think, 82. Finally, a bridge too far for Mr. Cherry.
Yeah, the Coach's Corner has been running for a long time, but he's been a commentator on off, I think, since the 70s. Yes, I'm old enough to remember the Don Cherry in the 70s. Plus, he was quite the shill for products back in the 80s, too. But anyway, I guess you got to pay the bills somehow. And, of course, he of Rock'em Sock'em Hockey, which I referenced off the top there, which is a video, was originally VHS tapes and then later DVDs of hockey players pounding the hell out of each other for years and years and years. A popular stocking stuffer in this nation. All that aside...
Still being put out, by the way.
Is it really?
It wasn't like in recent years, but it's like on DVD. I saw one like at Shoppers and somewhere. But yeah, like...
Yeah, it's still the dads like it, I guess, right?
The dads, yes.
So, yeah, the dads. Because the youngins are like... where did I see this one bit where they went to talk to hockey players at a rink and some of them didn't even know who Don Cherry was? I think that's more of a reflection of the times. Because the old... Everybody's sitting down to Hockey Night Canada on a Saturday. I think people still thought that, some people thought that Don Cherry was still in the employ of CBC. He isn't. Hockey Night Canada was some deal a few years ago and now belongs to Sportsnet. Yeah, Rogers. It's a Rogers joint now. So they finally pulled the plug on the guy whose plug, in my opinion, should have been pulled a long time ago. This is not new. He's been shooting off about issues such as this that are completely out of the hockey wheelhouse for years and years and years. And that's what I always found annoying about him. Not the bluster and the jackets and all that jive and his nice little dog, Blue. It was him feeling the need to have to comment on all of this stuff that's not hockey, right? He would just go, I don't know if it's filler or what. He was getting a heck of a lot of money. Do you remember that? No, of course we didn't talk about it because it was just, quite a bit before... we were doing these shows, though he had a contract dispute years and years ago with CBC, and he was pulling in $700,000 for doing the same shtick that he does now.
I found a Globe article from 2012 that said he was making $8 million.
Well, it did get bumped up, but the problem then was
he's probably making $1 million.
Ron McLean was upset that he was only making $6 million, and it caused this back and forth for a while until they just threw
he's
money
overpaid,
at
but
both of them.
Fine.
Yeah, they're all overpaid. Both of them for what they do are overpaid. I mean, they just come on in the three periods and talk about hockey. Yeah. So if he'd have stuck to that, he'd been fine. But he just can't help himself, and that's part of his routine, right? He's you know, I thought about it a bit. He is kind of Trump-like in his, you know, he never wavers from the things he just kind of says the same things over and over.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, then when he went into you people territory, they finally probably found the excuse that they could cut him loose.
Mm-hmm.
So, and rightly so, I
well,
think.
Jesse Brown made the interesting point on the New Canada Land today that, you know, maybe this is how he wanted it to end. He didn't
in
want
flames.
To have,
yeah.
Yeah, like he wanted to burn out, not fade away, which is, you know, how a lot of these longtime people go. But, you know, to talk about the salary he got for, you know, 10 minutes of broadcasting on one night a week, I guess maybe he does more during the playoffs, but still. Rogers owns Sportsnet. Rogers owns Hockey Night in Canada. Yeah, he did start on the CBC, and we can talk about CBC more in a minute. But, you know, Rogers has been letting people go left, right, and center at City TV, at the Rogers-owned radio stations, at McLean's. I mean, like, Rogers has let people go, like, Gord Martineau,
yeah,
Kevin Frankish, veteran. Jennifer yeah. Valentine. It's all, yeah. like, all ostensibly because they were, like, high income, like they'd been like seniority, like they had gotten the steady pay increases over the years, and like they weren't ready to retire. They were just kind of cast aside. It's like, oh, you're too expensive to have on staff anymore. But here's Don Cherry. It's like, what's getting you more value for your money? Like having experienced broadcaster working 5 mornings a week like Kevin Frankish, or having Don Cherry on Hockey Night in Canada? It's absurd. There's that part of it. The second part of it is Coach's Corner. Like he hasn't been a coach in 40 years, so like, yeah. How is he offering? Like, I'm not a sports ball person, but how is he offering like anything resembling like interesting, original insights into a game he's had no hand in shaping for nearly half a century? And that's, I mean, that I'm kind of like embellishing that, but I mean, it's been even like longer than that since he's been a player. So like, what does he have to offer exactly? And then the third thing is like, there were people online. After this, they're like, I'm getting rid of Sportsnet. This is ridiculous. It's like, really? You had a cable channel dedicated to sports, and by the way, is the exclusive broadcaster of half the major professional sports teams in Toronto, the Blue Jays and the Leafs.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get TSN to get the Raptors and the Argos.
And the soccer, yeah.
But, so you're going to, like, get rid of Sportsnet. You're going to get rid of your access to all these sports because they're not going to have Don Cherry on the payroll anymore. Like, those 10 minutes between the periods where he goes, hey, you know who's a sissy today? It's like these French guys. Like,
and the Europeans.
Like, really, that's...
They like to hit. Nah.
That enhances the enjoyment of the game? I hardly think so.
Yeah, and I love the fact, and you probably heard this too, that the Standards Council, the amount of complaints they got,
yeah.
like, maxed out the system.
Yeah,
and just
crashed the system.
Whoa.
Yeah. And they're not taking any more complaints on this too, because this is the other...
Because he's done.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, there's that, but the other point part of this too is that there was a woman on the CTV talk show, The Social, named Jess Allen,
mm-hmm.
who on Tuesday said that something to the effect of like she's had nothing but bad experiences with hockey players because they're all white alpha male bully types who, you know, are entitled because their parents spent $5,000 putting them in minor league hockey. And of course, when the neckbeards hear this, they immediately flood the broadcast standards lines. It's like, have you heard what this woman, Jess Allen, said? And that's when the CBSC then put out a statement. It's like, look, Jess Allen, Don Cherry, you like, do not bring this up anymore. We don't get, like, it's
yeah,
over.
We're done.
And I'm going to stick up for Jess Allen because, I mean, yeah, I've had some bad experiences with hockey and I've never played.
Oh.
But I've been the night manager of a hotel, and we've had hockey teams, peewee yeah. hockey teams, and it's not the kids. I mean, although the kids can get out of hand because, you know, they're mostly allowed to run wild and free, and it's all because of the parents. Hockey parents are the freaking worst. And you can flood these phone lines right now, and you can call the CBSC have me run off the community radio. But aside from like drunk people at the ranch, the worst experiences I had at the hotel involved hockey parents. And they use the fact that they spend all this money to put their youngster in hockey as a means to justify that they're so under stress, they're so busy taking their kid hither and yon. It's like, come on. You know it and I know it. You think your kid is the next Gretzky. You think they're the next Crosby. You're seeing dollar signs. You know, if you push them long enough, push them hard enough, that's money in the bank. Mm-hmm. Don't come at me that you are under stress, because like having 20 of you people yell at me at once, that was stressful.
Well, I'm going to date myself too, but I played hockey back when it didn't involve all of the traveling around that every single thing a kid does now seems to involve, whether it's dance or hockey. It's not just in your community. And I don't know if part of that is because that even though it is one of our national sports, it is sort of diminishing in importance in terms of like, when I was young, it was what you did. Like summer was baseball or soccer, and then the winter you played hockey because everybody played hockey, and there was several divisions within your age group.
Yeah,
it was all broken down 3-4 different teams of people your age, and that just doesn't exist anymore. So I think this is why they have to travel around. However,
except it's something about hockey, because I had
something about hockey
ringette parents super chill. Swimming parents, super chill.
Hear that ringing?
Dancing parents, super chill. It's there's something about hockey.
Something about hockey. I only played until I got to the age where young men want to beat the crap out of each other, and then I lost. I don't know. It's because I'm a European, but that's when I lost interest, because we would go to Etobicoke and everybody just wanted to kill you. I was like, oh yeah, this is fun. So that was when I quit. So you can call me a pussy if you want, but well, you know what I mean. This is Don Cherry would say I was a wuss of some kind or a European, which is true. But I'll take that. But I don't speak French.
But I mean, I'm pretty sure Don Cherry's been one of those people. It's like fighting's part of the game, and it's like no, it doesn't have to be.
Doesn't have to be. But that's I mean. It's funny how we've completely deviated from Don Cherry to start talking about hockey, but this is the thing. I can tell you with all honesty, in the 5 years looking back that I played hockey, and I played a lot of pickup hockey after that on a Wednesday night, the lunch bucket league, as they call it, and I enjoyed that far more, and it was at midnight on a work night. But I can tell you for certain that not one of my – I don't remember any of my coaches having a political opinion about anything.
Yeah.
I don't remember them – like, I just remember it being about – the sport. I don't recall there being any overlap with Poppy's or the stuff that Don Cherry was spouting about, and he continues to spout about. He made Fox News. That's funny.
Yeah,
I wonder who coordinated that.
I have no. I
the Ford team maybe or something.
I have no idea who might have.
Sorry, but, that's hearsay, folks. I just
Tucker
made that
Carlson
up,
it has turned his
these people are fascists.
Life.
That's
like,
all I saw.
But
yeah.
If you saw the clips, like Don Cherry is like kind of apologetic, like maybe I used the wrong word.
Canadian.
And Tucker Carlson goes, no, they are all wusses. They are fascists. They want to shut everybody up. Now you shut up, Don Cherry, and you believe that. Or like, I don't know. But I do want to talk about the epitome of all this, which is like the comment about Poppies.
Yeah.
Because Joe Warmington, the Night Scrawler.
That's right.
He went to a subway platform somewhere. I think it was Union Station. But he takes this 1-minute video of he's walking down the platform. He's like, oh, look at all these people not wearing poppies. And it's like actually several people are wearing poppies. But, well, I don't know. This is the thing. It's like he doesn't identify when he took this video. And if it was Union Station, there weren't that many people on the platform. So it was likely like I was either late in the evening or like the middle of the day if he took it on the Monday. So it's like if that's the case – technically, you're supposed to take the poppy off after the commemorations.
Yeah.
After the 11th hour, the poppy comes off. And like if you're at a cenotaph, you leave it at the cenotaph.
Yeah.
As a tribute.
Yeah.
So I don't know what you're trying to prove. But the part of this is, too, that it's no matter where you are, yes, someone went to war and maybe died. A lot of people died. A lot of people came back broken. These people suffered and gave their lives for an ideal, which is the ideals we live in according to freedom. Part of that, though, is the freedom to not wear something. Just as like part of your like part of freedom is being able to burn the flag of your country as well as revere it.
Mm-hmm.
There are people, and I don't necessarily agree with it, but there are people who see the poppy as a symbol of the glorification and deification of war.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's how what you believe and you don't want to wear poppy, that's legit. It shouldn't be a thing where like we're bullying people into it. Should we encourage people to remember? Should we encourage people to take that moment every 11th of November? Yes, of course. But if you're someone who has taken the time to educate yourself and you think, no, the poppy is a symbol of the glorification of war, so I will not participate in this. I will take the lessons of our wars past in another way. That's fine.
But that is something that's changed, that it has become about the glorification of war, whereas before it was, you know, the speeches used to be never again.
Yeah.
But then with help from people like Don Cherry, it became all about the glorification of war, because it used to be a commemoration of the dead. We are the dead. But now it's this sort of like, I mean, America, the U.S. breaks their veterans things down into three separate things: Memorial Day, and you know,
Veterans
there's the
Day,
veteran. You know, it's all segregated out. But ours has more become about the supporting the living veterans as well, which is not what it was about originally. And we could probably do another 15 on this, but we'll leave it at that. It's like I think part of it too is that the more we go cashless, the less we're going to see people buying poppies.
Well, this is 100%. The thing. There was a story that I didn't really get a chance to follow up on, that like the Legion was having trouble finding people to go out with the poppy boxes and stand there out in front of like stores with the poppy boxes. So, I mean, there's a point to that too. Yeah.
Anyway.
All right. Speaking of freedom.
Stay till next year.
The impeachment, the public impeachment inquiry into Donald Trump began Wednesday with Ambassador Bill Taylor, who was the acting ambassador to the Ukraine when all this stuff went down. About withholding military funds to the Ukraine in exchange for getting dirt on the Bidens to help Donald Trump's political fortunes in the 2020 election. Along with Mr. Taylor, George Kent, who was a Ukrainian expert with the State Department. He was an assistant secretary of state who had expertise in the Ukraine and Eastern Europe. They both testified in open session. This was the first open testimony heard in the impeachment inquiry. They've been meeting behind closed doors for several weeks now. Not a great start for Republicans.
No, and I noticed, excuse me, right off the bat, they do persist with these stupid signs, eh? I didn't even get to read any of them, but they, you know, they put those signs up behind them and says, you know, Trump's innocent, and they have these props. That is something that wouldn't be allowed in Canada's props like that.
You probably couldn't get away with that in the House, no.
No, but then in the I was going to say the run-of-the-mill stuff. This is far from run-of-the-mill. And was it Taylor? It's not that I get what the Republicans are saying, but Taylor was quoted as saying that Ambassador Sutherland said Trump cared more about the Bidens than the Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's becoming all about that it's let's get the dirt on Hunter. What about Hunter? What about Hunter? Trump just seems to be parroting the same stuff all the time. I mean, we know this, but what I find interesting is this. They asked them, the part that I saw was they're asking, are you a never Trumper? Like, it's not even grammatically correct. It's just become a thing. Are you a never Trumper?
It's because Donald Trump has said,
no, sir, I'm an ambassador. And then they asked the one guy, like, I'm not actually an ambassador. I'm, you know, I'm also a client. No, I don't know what it was, but it's like,
right.
But it's getting, I don't know.
I mean, the whole thing was embarrassing. And there's been a lot of commentary about how in order, and this is a headline from the Chicago Tribune, that to watch the impeachment inquiry, you needed a Fox News conspiracy to English translator, which is fairly accurate.
Yeah.
Because like they keep bringing up all these things, like names of people who have been like tacitly involved, and it keeps getting further away from the heart of the matter, which is that by all appearances, Donald Trump ordered these funds that were meant to go to help fight or to help procure military equipment for the Ukrainians to fight Russians along the Crimea frontier,
mm-hmm,
in exchange for dirt. Or not exchange for the dirt itself, but in exchange for the prime minister of the Ukraine coming out and saying, I am ordering an investigation into the behaviors or misbehaviors, alleged or Unreal. although he probably wouldn't say that, but you know, investigation into Hunter Biden and whether or not his father had anything to do with him having his position with Burisma, which is this energy company in Ukraine that Hunter Biden was on the board for. And I mean, then there were a couple of damning parts. Where, like, one of them is this call that Taylor's aide overheard with Sondland.
This is like a different call, right?
Right.
Is this the other call that he said?
This is the call, like,
the call after the call.
Taylor said that his aide, whose name is David Holmes, who you better believe he's been subpoenaed, overheard a call with Ambassador Sondland, who was the ambassador to the EU and technically should have had no part of anything going on in the Ukraine since the Ukraine is not part of the European Union. But
it's European-ish, right? Yeah.
Well, because Sondland was a gold star donor to the Trump inaugural, he gets the position of EU ambassador. But Holmes overhears this call where he could hear Trump on the other end asking Sondland if the deal was done, if they're going to get dirt on the Bidens or not. And that's where Taylor's other commentary that it was like that it seemed that the president was more interested in getting the dirt, quote unquote, the dirt, than actually helping people. And then you had Republicans focusing on, well, did you, like, first of all, have you guys ever talked to the president? And they haven't. And I think one of the crooked media guys pointed this out. It's like, because crimes only happen when you talk to the person committing them, right? That's the goal. That's the standard.
Usually, yeah.
But the other part of it was that they were focusing on, too, was that they didn't know that the aid was being held up until they got this dirt right. Like, you guys didn't know that at the time, right? And it's like, well, what other conclusion are you meant to draw from this? Because, yeah, they didn't know it at the time. But on September 9th, the White House releases the funds to the Ukraine, which is, coincidentally or not, 2 days after the House starts investigating this after they get the whistleblower complaint. And that's the other thing, too, is that they keep saying, we need to talk to this whistleblower. Where is this whistleblower? And they don't need – like, practically speaking, they don't need the whistleblower because everything the whistleblower has said has been corroborated by half a dozen other people.
Yeah, and they've become obsessed with the whistleblower, right?
Yeah.
And there was – what was the there was a vote about the – wasn't there a vote about the whistleblower having to testify? And, of course, the Democrats rejected it.
Yeah.
Not by much. So it would be –
well, there was – I mean –
you know, cover up.
Yeah.
Doctored fake. It's all fake. It's really fake. The interestingly, but on the orders of the White House, Mulvaney and Bolton were told not to testify. And supposedly that is impeachable as well, preventing – people from testifying at something like at an impeachment inquiry is impeachable. So it's like they just the hole is getting dug.
Well, one of the things that got Nixon on was obstruction of Congress, which is what this is. Bolton at least shows some degree of willing. I mean, this is like getting into the weeds on this. Not that this isn't like weedy as it is, but Bolton wants the court to say he can testify. Basically, he can override Trump and testify. He wants that assurance before he goes in. Fair enough. But, I mean, who knows how long that will take. Mulvaney tried to attach himself to Bolton's motions.
Yeah.
And the Bolton team was like, nuh-uh. You're the dude who went out into the little-used White House press gallery and basically admitted the whole thing.
Cobweb.
So, like, we don't want you to get your cooties on us. And so Mulvaney then went and tried to launch his own motion, and then he eventually gave that up, and now he's just doing the I'm not going to talk at all kind of thing. But, I mean, do we need him to talk?
He's
already confessed.
Probably not, but, I mean, I guess it's one of those the more the merrier thing, because we know that this – I mean, I'm not sure people completely understand the process. So we have this going on right now, and then if the House – the House representative votes to charge the president, which they're probably going to. Then it goes to the Senate, and the Senate, which is full of a Republican majority, are probably going to shoot it down. So I think the idea is to get as much evidence as possible from as many people as possible at this point, because this may not go further than the Senate. And it was interesting what Nancy Pelosi said today. I don't know if you saw it, but she accused Trump of bribery. I mean, that's essentially
what this is.
Yes. But if you just sort of said that without any backing, like it's almost a libelous statement. If I accused Adam or whatever, it would be like, yeah. It would be libelous. So she's, I mean, you're sort of sticking your neck out saying something like that, saying, okay, you're, and she also said that, you know, compared to what Nixon did, that when, you know, Nixon was small potatoes, and I'm like, whoa, that's heavy duty saying
yeah.
that.
But well, I mean,
that might be a bit of a stretch, but
I don't know if it's a stretch. I mean, what was Watergate about? It was like them trying to break, like a bunch of guys broke into Democratic National headquarters and ransacked the filing cabinet. This was a coordinated effort.
It's like the break-in without the break-in.
Of like a shadow State Department trying to get dirt to help the president's electoral fortunes, where they're like where they're leveraging the funds of taxpayer funds that were being allocated to help an ally. It does almost feel worse. It is interesting to hear Nancy Pelosi say that, because Nancy Pelosi has been the one who's been trying to throttle back on getting people in terms of reining the Democrats who want to go impeachment in. The thing about the whole Senate aspect of this, too, is that they need three or four Republican senators to vote to make it a secret ballot.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it has to be, show of hands. Everybody has to go on the record. And you need 2/3. The assumption is if everyone,
right. Yeah. 66.
If everyone gets to vote in secret, the supermajority is easier to get, because there are a lot of Republicans in the Senate who don't enjoy this.
So they might be able to pull a procedural.
Who knows what happened? Mitch McConnell could pull a Merrick Garland and just say, you know what, I'm not going to bring this to the floor. And then that would go to court, and then by the time you get to the election.
He's no longer
the end game of this, I don't think, in practical terms, I don't think the end game was ever to remove Trump from office. It was to get Republicans in the Senate to say one way or the other if Trump is fit for office. And if that's what it comes down to, that means big trouble for a lot of people in the Senate, including Joni Ernst, Cory Gardner, Susan Collins, like the people who are vulnerable in 2020.
They were all never Trumpers anyway.
Anyway.
And what was the bit about Giuliani today? Giuliani said that he has insurance if Trump throws him under the bus. Now, there's a bit of a double entendre there. Is what kind of insurance? Like, you're going to get good health insurance?
Right.
Like, what are you trying to say?
I can't remember what I was listening to, but somebody said, like, you'll notice that Giuliani, whenever there's talk about throwing Giuliani under the bus, he suddenly appears on Fox News or wherever to talk to remind
people.
I've
got good insurance.
He does know where the bodies are buried, and they're all listed in his oversized iPhone. Okay, so
that
we're
he can't get into,
or that he butt dials people
I can't
on.
Can't get into it.
Anyway, we're gonna take a quick break and then reset with our special guests. You're listening to Open Source of Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. There's nothing about CBC. It's from behind the scene. It's all right to bomb a few foreigners from the sky.
Celebrate the ass we kick on a foreign stage. The only leaf I see is losing 6-3, and that's fine with me. Oh, I know.
From Bandcamp. That's a band called The Consumer Goods from a lot of years ago called Hockey Night in Afghanistan, referencing Don Cherry from many, many years ago.
It's such a Scotty song.
I get
Scotty
it. It's kind of too. Hey, yeah. I actually know this guy, but anyway.
Of course you do.
Of course I do.
Okay, so we shouldn't laugh too much because we're going to talk about some very serious things. So we have with us in studio Robert McCabe of Recovery Speaking.
Yes.
Bob, thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And via the telephone, we have Matt Gallagher, who is the director of the new documentary Prey, which will be playing this Saturday at 7 p.m. at the River Run Center. And Matt, you are with us?
Yes. How are you doing?
I am good. Thank you so much for joining us, too. So the documentary, it's about one very specific case of sex abuse by a Catholic priest. Perhaps we can also read this as a sort of a universal story, too, that there are so many victims who are going through their own legal or psychological or emotional stuff, and you are among them too. You are a survivor.
I'm a survivor of clerical abuse. Yes.
Yeah. Can you tell a little bit about your story? And
yeah, I'm 67 years old now.
You don't look it.
Well, thank you. Get your eyes checked. Your glasses need changing. I'm as young as Matt, right, Matt?
Yeah.
But the abuse took place in 1963 when I was 11 years old. And it was almost atypical for a clerical sexual abuse, if a clerical sexual abuse can be typical, where he targets certain styles or types of boys, you know, the naive, shy, laid-back kind of thing,
right.
And then grooms them. I was groomed for about a year where, you know, just being a friend, taking you out to places, kind of hugging you, this kind of thing, and then also getting in with the trust of my parents, coming over to the house, having tea with mom, you know, seeing dad and this kind of thing. So he's a trusted member and trusted friend of the family.
Right.
And in 1963, the collar represented God. It's I think, a different look now when you look at religion and ministries and so on. But at that point in time, we were taught very, very strongly, you do not question the priest. He is next to God. So when he says do something, you do it because that is coming direct from God. And so in the summer of 1963, he asked my parents if I could go to Montreal with him to serve Mass in the Basilica. They agreed to it. We were on the way to Montreal. A number of things happened in the ride where he started talking about sex. He started talking about sexual activities and things like masturbation and these kinds of things. Now, at 11 years old, in 1963, I didn't even know what he was talking about.
Right.
And we stopped in Cornwall, and at a motel in Cornwall is where the abuse took place in the evening. Well, that night, the whole night. And we then moved on from there. We went to Montreal. I have no recollection of the morning. And I won't go into the details of it because it's just not appropriate. But in the morning, I have no recollection of driving to Montreal, but I remember being in the Basilica. And I served Mass for him. And this Father Alphonse Robert came up to me and said, do you want to confess your sins before I say Mass? And this is about 3 hours after he had stopped abusing me. And it's this kind of arrogance that I think has been seen through it all. When I got home, that day we left and came home because I demanded to go home. And I remember going up the driveway, going up the sidewalk, hitting the front door of my house in Scarborough, Ontario. And I have no recollection of going in. No recollection of talking to my parents about it. There was absolute black, which is very common within losing periods and chunks and significant periods of time because of the trauma. And that was my experience.
And Matt, you're the filmmaker behind this film. How did you, I mean, the subject is a man named Rod, whose story similar but different from Bob's here. How did you meet Rod and how did you start with the idea of turning his story and his legal fight into a film?
Well, once I, you know, I mean, I grew up an altar boy in Windsor, Ontario, and you know, I mean, when Bob's telling me his story, when I'm listening to his story, it's tragically and sadly familiar with them, with all of these survivors that I keep on hearing from. So I had wanted to do a story on this subject on clerical abuse for a decade or so. And, you know, I'm a documentary filmmaker, and I, you know, be honest with you, I didn't know how to tell the story. I didn't know how to tell it because we're always looking for, in documentary, some sort of current, story that's happening. So the camera is there as the story unfolds before it. So I sort of sat on it for a long time, and then I reached out to a friend of mine who was actually abused, and he was in the film. His name is Patrick McMahon, and he was abused in Windsor, Ontario. And I reached out to him, and I sat down with him, and we had a long conversation. And he told me, you know, about all the abuse, but more importantly for the film, what he did is he opened my eyes to this whole other world of the civil suit and where money is being exchanged and there's trials and settlements and non-disclosure agreements and all this stuff going on behind the scenes that you really don't hear about at all. And that's when I became interested in doing a documentary. So Patrick introduced me to this lawyer known as the Priest Hunter. His name's Rob Talek, and he's in the film.
He's very proud of his epitaph, by the way.
Yeah. And Rob is, he's filed more than 400 cases against the church, and he's very good at what he does. He's very good at representing survivors and victims. And so he introduced me to this case that was just about to happen. And the thing with these cases is that 99% of them, except for Rod's and except for Bob's, they usually get settled behind the scenes. But Bob and Rod McLeod both decided to take theirs to a civil trial. So I saw this opening, and the survivors wanted me to tell their story, and the rest is history. I mean, after I got access to that story, the film happened very quickly.
Mm-hmm. So Matt, both Adam and I have seen the film, and something that I was surprised about, and I wanted to get clarification from you, was the Father Kotalski, who I guess was a friend,
Father Marshall.
Marshall. I dropped his name there for a second, but there's so many names crossing over.
Right.
Was he there just sort of representing? Was he there representing the church? Was he there representing himself as a friend of Marshall's, or? No, I thought it was interesting because it must be obviously really difficult to get something resembling balance. And I was almost surprised that he was in
that
the
he took
film
part,
and he
yeah.
took part in it. So how did you get him to participate?
Well, Father Kotalski is the spokesperson for the Brazilian church.
Oh, okay.
And so his job is to deal with trials and settlements and survivors and victims and lawyers and that's what his job is. He spends a big chunk of his career as a priest to sort of settle these cases and to write checks, and so I approached him. I mean, I sat behind him in the trial. He was there for the 3-week trial, and I didn't introduce myself until after the trial was finished. But I got a meeting with him, and I went in there with my producer, and we sat and we talked to Father Kotalski, and I'm curious. I'm sure survivors like Bob and Rod feel very differently about Kotalski because they've been dealing with people like him for years and years. But I gave him the benefit of the doubt, and I wanted to find out, what's it like doing his job? It must be very difficult. I'm sure he didn't enter the priesthood or the seminary to be the Brazilian spokesperson, but here he has a job to do, and so I interviewed him, and he was very candid, and he had a chance to say what he needed to say.
Right, he is an interesting character because you can see the struggle in those interviews where he knows, even if he didn't know at the time, he knows now, and he knows how wrong it is. But there's a parting line he has to follow, and I mean this is reflected too in. The scene with Patrick sort of demonstrating outside the church and the priest approaches him and talks to him and is forced to confront this, potentially a member of his own parish that was subject of this abuse. And it makes me wonder, in your experiences, how are other clergy sort of processing this? How are people of faith processing this? Because we talk a lot about being amongst predators and people we know and trust being revealed as predators. This is a big part of the Me Too movement as well. How do you reconcile when someone you trust, and you're part of that system, and how do you work from within that system? How do
it's
got to
be really hard. Yeah. I know the judicial vicar in my case, Father Clough, from the Archdiocese of Toronto. I spoke to him about it, and it's not something that's easy. Mm. They have to represent the church. They have to do their job. They have to get the best deal they can, because when it comes down to it, it's the money that drives the decisions. It's the insurance companies. It's the lawyers who drive these decisions. And I think there's a very strong conflict between those two areas. And I think as far as in addition to the clergy, the the people who are going to church and the worshipers at the church, and then every Sunday you saw it in the movie with the woman who drove up and said, you know, what are we going to do? And they're just going to come back to us for more money on this.
Yeah.
I think there's a real conflict. And when I speak to people and when I speak to members of churches about it, there's a real conflict because it's wrong. But this goes to the core. This goes to their very essence in their faith. And it's shattering in many cases. So it's very difficult right now.
So there was a screening of the film down in Cornwall, which you went down for. You live in Guelph now, is that right?
I'm in Guelph.
You live in Guelph. And I think it had said that it was somewhere upwards of 60 priests were invited to this screening. And it was like five?
Canadian Congress of Catholic Bishops were taking their annual meeting there.
Uh-huh.
And we invited, I think it was 93, 94 bishops. It was 90 plus bishops. So, and out of that, they sent a delegation of five to the screening.
And were you somewhat surprised that even five had shown up, or?
I thought it was good. I thought it was good that five had shown up. I know I wasn't directly involved in organizing that. That mm-hmm. was through a group called SNAP and Brenda Burnell in Windsor.
Mm-hmm.
But they were disappointed. And I think the media afterward reflected that and what Brenda said afterward. They thought they would have more representation because the church is saying one thing and seems to be doing another.
Matt, you are approaching this as a storyteller. And this is like a story that has been getting more and more attention, probably not as quickly as some people who would hope. And I mean, there's been a big Academy Award winning movie about this with Hollywood stars, and you're making movies, other people are making movies. It still seems like this issue is sort of struggling to get attention. You know, if you think about something like the Me Too scandal, it turned very, very quickly, and people were deplatformed at the earliest instance of an allegation. But what is it about this issue and this institution that is sort of making it so hard to get the justice that the victims deserve?
Huge question, and I don't even know the answer. I mean, I mean, you know, I'm no longer Catholic. I've been a Catholic for decades, but you know, my parents are, and they still go to church, and they still they support victims, but they still drop their, you know, their $20 in the basket every week. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of people who think that, you know, it's just a few bad priests, and sadly, it's not. I mean, it sort of reminds me of, you know, we like talk about, you know, the police force and crooked cops and the blue wall and not like reporting on your brother. Like, I mean, if you're a cop or a priest and your colleagues are doing bad shit, I think it's your duty to like say something. And strangely, that's not happening. So I wish this documentary could satisfy, you know, and give an answer that would help me understand that. But you know, I spent a long time on the story, and I'm sure Bob would have more insight onto that. But I, you know, sadly, I don't know. I just don't know.
I want to do talk about your group, Recovery Speaking, because you've not actually tried to help, you know, reconcile your own trauma, but you're helping other people try and reconcile theirs. So how do you make that leap? How did you find that strength to try and turn the negative into
a
positive?
That's another great question that would only take about 3 hours to answer. But ultimately, what came about was this process started in 2013.
Mm-hmm.
I should mention, and it's widely known, I've reported it already, but I'm also alcoholic. I'm in recovery. And I was in recovery from alcoholism for 3 years and then started on the recovery path of the sexual abuse. And at that point in time, it just was something I had to do to try to come to terms and come to grips with it. And what I found was in my growing up and in my adulthood and everything else, I had played the victim really hard. You know, I really had used that, and then put the alcohol on top of that, and it just flourished. So that when I got into recovery and I had the gift of people coming into my line of sight, like Rob Talek, like Paula Dwat, who was my lawyer, of counselors, of people supporting me. Once we got this done, my wife and I both felt we had to give back. And one of the things I saw was there are a ton of men and women in trauma, a lot from sexual abuse. You know, you look at 1 in 3 women are sexually abused, 1 in 6 men, and men never talk about this thing. Yeah. And we take it to the grave stuff. And it's just the nature of the beast that we don't talk about this because I don't want you thinking about me in a certain way.
Mm.
And so this recovery speaking hopefully will give a voice and a platform that we can raise some money, that we can pay for people to get trauma counseling that they need but they can't afford because OHIP doesn't cover it.
Yeah.
And I don't know that many addicts and alcoholics and people who are down and out who have group benefit programs that pay for it. So we want to raise money in order to pay for that trauma counseling, and then that will probably lead to other things to assist in recovery from trauma.
Mm-hmm. Matt, I hope this isn't another big question, but I am curious about how this has sort of affected your own faith. You said you're not a practicing Catholic anymore. You know, was that before you started, you know, working on this issue, or and has that just exacerbated the problem, or you know, in terms of, you know, your own spirituality, you know, where does that lie after being ensconced in this project for so long?
Well, yeah, I mean, I haven't been Catholic for decades, so I mean, what I find, you know, disappointing and sadly surprising is the fact that the church isn't doing the right thing on these cases.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we followed Rod McLeod's case in trial, and a jury of 6 people came back and gave him an impressive award, and they thought they decided after hearing all the evidence that Rod deserves $2.57 million, and mm-hmm. When I heard that the church appealed that, it just sort of broke my heart. It's just like, man, you know, like after all that, you still can't, you know, give this guy what he deserves or give this guy what, you know, it was awarded by the jury.
Yeah.
And I just like, listen, I mean, I have no problem with the church. You know, it does a lot of good for some people, but, I think they're behaving badly when it comes to dealing with survivors. So I would like to see things happen differently, but I'm not sure we will.
Can I just say one thing to that? Mm-hmm. When I went to the appeal, in fact, Matt was at Rod's appeal as well, and what was disgraceful was not only that they appealed it, because that appeal was thrown out at the end of the day, but they demeaned Rod McLeod, who was sitting in the courtroom at the time, the church's lawyers, and literally his own integrity. They tore at his integrity. Mm. They tore at the man who had been through this trauma and had the audacity in order to try to save a few dollars to do that.
Mm.
That is what is making survivors, and it makes me just cringe. And they did it in my case, and they did it in my appeal, and I saw them do it in Rod's, and I was a spectator there, so I saw it. And I just want to echo what Matt said, because the church is doing one thing, but then their lawyers and insurance companies have free rein to do else, you know, everything else, and it's deplorable what they're doing.
Which is interesting, because when we're talking about people who need to leave Scientology, there's that campaign too, that we're going to follow you, we're going to demean you, we're going to, you know, create websites that take things you've done out of context. And, you know, I hate to say it, we expect better of the Catholic Church, but we expect better of the Catholic Church.
We do.
Let me ask you both, and maybe we can start with you, Bob. Assuming that the church comes to its senses and, like, really wants to deal with this and to really work with survivors and really address the persistent problem that still exists, what does that look like? Like, what does the process of reconciliation look like to you, that the things the church should do to try and reach out to survivors like you?
I think it's going to happen in the back rooms.
Mm.
I don't think it's going to happen in the adversarial situation we currently have between survivors and the church.
Mm.
Nobody wins in that situation. And what we want to do within Recovery Speaking is, in advocacy, is bring another voice to the table where we can sit down not in front of the cameras, not with the newspapers, not with the radios, and say, okay, what can we do to solve this? You have to open up the archives. You have to, you know, give a list of priests who have credible charges against them in the diocese. Now, what can you do? So we're sitting there and we do it jointly. I've talked to a couple of bishops, and I'm meeting with the bishop from Hamilton, hopefully within the next 2-3 weeks, hope before Christmas, and maybe we can start that dialogue. Because I think as individuals, you know, there's bad decisions as an institution, but I think there's some good individuals there that we can work with and grow and maybe see some things there. But we're not going to do it in front of the TV cameras.
Fair enough. Matt?
Oh, man, Bob, I love what you said, and I wish I shared your enthusiasm. But, I hope you're right. I hope that can be done, you know.
Yeah.
Bob, you've been doing this longer than I have, and you've been dealing with this longer than I have, and so I'm just scratching the surface here. But what I'm scratching it, I just don't have as much hope as you do, I think, sadly. But
yep.
Anyways, I hope you're right. I hope you're right, Bob.
Maybe we can wrap up here. What do you guys hope people leave the movie with when they see it on Saturday? Like, people will engage in this movie and they'll say to themselves, like, what can I do? And you know, what's something that you wish they'd take away?
I think what the theme for this week, and I've been to 2 or 3 of the viewings, and what I want to achieve with Recovery Speaking here is an evening of hope and recovery. That's what this is about. We're going to watch the documentary, and we're going to have a discussion with Rob Talek and Rod McLeod and a couple of the other people that are going to be there. Patrick may be here. And we're going to talk about, you know, there is survival after sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to trigger trauma within the audience that night, mm-hmm. and the fight or flight syndrome and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping there can be something where those who are just there to see what the thing's about will come away with more knowledge. And those who have had some kind of trauma in their past know that there's someplace they can go, even if they just called me, and because everybody will have my number at the end of the thing, and we can start to talk and see where we can send you to get some help.
And Matt?
I think that journalism and, you know, what you guys are doing on the radio and documentaries, I think they shine a light on this stuff. And, you know, Bob called me a month or so ago and said he wanted to host this screening. Yeah. And I think that's wonderful. I think the more places we can show this, you know, in cities and church basements and concert halls and movie theaters across the country, just let's get this movie out there. Let's get people talking about it, because I think when you shine a light on this stuff, things get better.
I know I've also been approached, 30 seconds here, by your student association.
Okay.
And we're talking about bringing this film, you don't even know this, Matt, bringing the documentary just to a student population here on site, mm-hmm. and doing a panel and discussion with regard to students and sexual abuse within the university culture. So yeah, we're talking about that for the new year.
Okay. Well, breaking news for the film's director right here. Bob, do you want to just quickly give out the details for Recovery Speaking if people feel like they want to reach out?
Sure. We can be reached at info@recoveryspeaking.org. The documentary goes Saturday night, 7 p.m., free admission. We're not charging anything for the viewing at the River Run Center. Doors will open probably about 6:15. And, you know, there's probably going to be about 100 there, and we're hoping even more. We can capacitate, I think 225 okay. is the capacity. And then we're going to have the panel afterward and just see where it goes. So,
okay.
But you can reach me through that web or that email.
Okay. Well, Bob McCabe, thank you so much for telling your story
My
today.
Pleasure.
And,
thank you.
And Matt Gallagher, thank you so much for your storytelling. And we will hopefully see a big crowd out for the movie on Saturday. Thank you so much.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, guys.
All right, and that is it for this week's show. You can find us on our website, opensourcesguelph.com, on Facebook at Open Sources Newswire, and on Twitter at @OS_Guelph. If you'd like to listen to the show again, you can download it from our website every Monday or on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, and you can find me at my news and politics site, Guelph Politico.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at spanderbook.wordpress.com.
And stay tuned for DJ Sounds Good to Me here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We will be back here next Thursday at 5 p.m. for more open sources, and we'll see you then.